You are listening to Punk News Podcast, and today is a very special episode. Why? Because this week and today, right now, if you're listening today, is the reissue after, let's see here, 10, 20, almost 30, no, 30 years since the release of a seminal album, an album that shook the foundations of punk rock and hardcore in the early 90s, a record that came out while all the other punk bands were gone poppy and radio-friendly, was mean, nasty, savage, raw-sounding. We are talking about the reissue, which is out today via Trust Records, the label that reissued Circle Jerks, 7 Seconds, and some other cool stuff. The reissue of DFL Dead Fucking Last, first album, My Crazy Life. This is a track off the album. This is one of my favorite tracks off the album, although every track is great. This is America's Most Hardcore.
We're Dead Fucking Last. I'm Crazy Tom, Crazy Marnie, Crazy Adam, and Fucked Up Tony! Fuck you.
Tom and Monty, Monty and Tom. Tom and
hey,
Monty,
what's going on?
Thanks for being on the show. The listeners probably know Tom Davis is the singer of DFL, and Monty is the guitar player for DFL. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk about the reissue, we're going to talk about the album, we're going to talk a little bit about the history, and we're going to play a bunch of cool stuff. Tom and Monty, what the listeners might not know is DFL formed in 92, 93, but you guys have known each other since like 1981 or 1982, right?
I think we've actually known each other longer, don't you think, Tom?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I think
I feel like we were hanging out together. We were hanging out in Malibu at your dad's house in 79.
That's right.
So Monty and Tom go way back to, you know, the early LA or early SoCal skater scene and also the early SoCal punk scene. So did you guys link up through skateboarding, through punk rock? How'd you guys link up?
All of that. First it came skateboarding, and then came the first generation of punk rock, which were the first punk bands out of SoCal.
Tom, what were the early days of SoCal skateboarding like? Like, was it a dangerous scene? Was it a safe scene? What kind of people would you see skateboarding? What was your own skateboarding style like? How did you develop your own skateboarding style?
I guess, you know, we were lucky enough to be right in the middle of the whole Dogtown generation and Z-Boys and Valley skateboarders. There was ValSurf, Kent, Senator, Turning Point. There was Dogtown. There was Alva Skateboards. Looking back, we were just right in the middle of it all. It was pretty amazing. And I had a nickname from my friend named Drew called Monk. Which was a pretty cool, pretty fun nickname. We have a song called Monk's Honor in the on the record. I guess I sort of just developed a thrashing style of skateboarding, imitating all my peers, which were Jay Adams, Tony Alva, Bob Beniac, Billy Huron, Jimmy Plumer. I mean, the list just goes on. You name it. Fucking, I idolized that style of skateboarding, which was just aggressive, balls out skating.
Tom, you but around then you were actually friends and still are, but you became friends with Jim and Fletcher of Pennywise, right?
Yeah, that was when my father died of cancer when we were in Malibu, and I didn't want to stay with my mom anymore. I had no place to live, so I went to live with my mom in Hermosa Beach, which I enrolled in Maricosta, and that's where I met Fletcher and Jim. I shared a math class with Jim, and actually turned him on to some Dead Kennedy stuff right off the bat. I already had that stuff in my cassette player. So, yeah.
With regards to the Hermosa Beach, I forget if it was Tom or Monty, but isn't there like a story where you guys would like skate into the Black Flag practice area and they would like chase you out or something?
That would have been the Hermosa Beach church. We were skating around the church quite often, and I remember one time those guys went off to a show and we snuck into the church and took flyers off the walls, and we got chased out. I think it was by Spot, who was like loading the shit up. I think the band was already on their way there, but yeah, we were lucky enough to like see all the generations of Black Flag, from Keith to Chavo to Dez to Henry, and fucking epic genre of punk for sure.
Tom, who gets your number one pick for best Black Flag vocalist? I'm always going to go Keith. I mean, I love them all, but for me, Keith is the tops.
I think it actually goes from, exactly, it goes from Keith to Chavo to Dez to Henry. I think Henry definitely brought like a different experience to the flag, and I guess I just love it all. I did like Dez a lot growing up, but lately I really like Chavo's voice and stuff on those recordings. I mean, the recordings of Black Flag are just so fucking raw and really, really good. It's mind-blowing how really great that stuff is.
And Monty, around that time, you had your first punk band, The Adams, right?
Yep.
So who was in The Adams, and what kind of band was that, and who did you play with?
The Adams, it was me and my best friend, who also was a good friend of Tom's, Taz. Taz lived out in Malibu. Well, his grandparents lived in Malibu, and his mom lived in South Pasadena. And actually, Taz and I also kind of met up skateboarding out at Reseda Skater Cross on the bus to Reseda. And we started a band. And I think for us, like, our big influences in the Adams is we were really into Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. So that was like our huge influence for that band, sort of kind of like punk. And the Sex Pistols also, kind of thrashy punk rock and roll stuff. And me, Taz, and then the early Adams, we had Oscar Harvey, or Harvey Oscar, we could never know which one went first in his name. And he played bass. And then we had Jeff Isabel, who played with us, who went on to play guitar as Izzy Stradlin in Guns N' Roses. Remember, he left the Adams. He played drums in the Adams. And then he was like, oh, I'm going to go start like a rock band. And we were like, whatever. And joined Guns N' Roses. And I remember seeing Guns N' Roses like at a frat house. We were like, all right, we're all going to go out and support Izzy. And went to UCLA to some frat house. Saw them play in the living room. And they blew our minds. They were so fucking good. I mean, it was great. And I remember Axel was wearing like these assless chaps and just like freaking all the frat house guys out. But yeah, we had a bunch of other people in the Adams too. Michael F. Glass, who was in Sin 34, played bass with us for a while, and Drew Bernstein, who was in America's Hardcore, and I feel like I'm forgetting somebody. But yeah, it was a fun band. We played a lot. We were also like on drugs most of the time, and played some really great shows, and didn't really record anything though, unfortunately.
So I guess around that time, Tom, what music was really influencing you, and Monty, like, what music was really influencing you? Actually, well, so Tom, around that time, what music was really influencing you?
I would say definitely Orange County hardcore was really big. So we were going to a lot of TSOL shows down in Huntington, and I was bi-coastal. So I had friends in Hollywood, which were Monty and Drew. So we were going to like those punk shows, which were like Monty was saying, those were like, that was the original kind of Sunset Strip punk that turned out to grow to be more of a Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue kind of scene. So Monty was writing the beginning of that, where there was also beach punks, which were Black Flag and, you know, the Gears. So I was influenced by that. And then also Monty remembers he was also playing with Germs. The Germs were also a big Hollywood band, and we loved the Germs. So I had a taste of it all. I don't think Monty saw Black Flag, some of the early stuff, but it was great because we were just there. The scene was so friendly there. You could go from scene to scene, and it was just overlapping and a really great time. And then it started to get really hectic with you know, creative control of gangs and stuff, and it started to get a little hectic. But yeah, so some of that, it was just great to be in the beginning of all of that scene going on. Don't you think, Monty?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's so funny that you said like Orange County, cause that's that I thought the exact same thing, you know. I mean, it was, you know, adolescence, you know, social distortion, adolescence.
Yeah.
You know, which were guys our own age, but like for me and the Adams, like we couldn't get our shit together, but those guys, they were playing and making really amazing music. And you go see them, like Tom said, you go see them at the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown, and then you go see them at the Fleetwood in Redondo, you know, or Hermosa. Where was the Fleetwood? I can't remember.
It was Redondo, which is Redondo. Right on the tip of Hermosa.
Yeah, so you go down to the Fleetwood and you know, drive down there and see all the same bands, you know, at that, or go to the Starwood in West Hollywood. There's just all these clubs, like you could go every night, go to the Vex in East LA, and just see all the bands, you know, TSOL, the Germs, Circle Jerks, Black Flag, you know, all of them. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah, all of them. So all of those flyers are real.
And actually, Tom, you're on the cover of Circle Jerks Group Sex, aren't you?
Yes. That's one of my claim to fames. Me and Monty had a friend. I might have been more friendly with this guy named Rob Henley, who was a friend of Darby Crash's. And the Adolescents had a song about him called No Friends. And we befriended Rob because he was kind of hooking us up with some party favors. And so that Circle Jerks cover was Rob Henley and Gerber, which was also a friend of Darby Crash's, a fake wedding reception, which was basically a way for Robbie and Gerber to get free drugs and free money. So I think the Jerks played that night. I can't remember who else played, but I do remember, I believe it was Ed Culver, who was like, everybody get in the Red Bull, get in the bowl. And, you know, we all.
That was at Marina Del Rey, right?
Yeah, that was at Marina Del Rey skate park.
Yeah.
So that was fun. A lot of those people in that photo, some of them are still around and some of them are not. I know there's Potato Head, Mark Alves in that. Just a lot of great friends in that photo.
So let's play something from Circle Jerks Group Sex, also released via Trust Records. And then we're going to play We're Only Going to Die by Bad Religion's How Could Hell Be Any Worse, which would just be just a little bit after that, but would be very important in the DFL story. So this is Circle Jerks, and then we're going to play some Bad Religion, We're Only Going to Die, which was, of course, later covered by Sublime, which also has a DFL connection, as does TSOL. But we'll be right back.
Innocent until I'm proven guilty. Guilty, deny, everything.
far back. So Monty, you kind of dropped out of the punk scene after like what, 82 or 80, not dropped out isn't the right word, but you had other things going on after like 82 or 83, correct?
Yeah, like 82, 83 ended up getting just drugs, just out of control, strung out on drugs, and couldn't really stay, you know, wasn't going to shows, wasn't doing anything, was just chasing my addiction, which thank God, you know, I survived, but it was pretty brutal.
So you and Tom didn't really see each other during that period too much, correct?
No, I don't think we did, because I was going to shows and I'd see Tom like at like the Starwood, and you know, and we'd be like, yeah, you know, just good to see you and stuff like that. But then once I was like really in my addiction, it was a whole other group of people, just to say the least.
Yeah, I would see Monty around, and you know, I don't think Monty was skateboarding as much back then, but I was hanging out with some hardcore heavy skater punkers, man, and they were pretty aggressive kids. They were fighting a lot every night, and Monty's whole thing was like loving drugs. You know, he wasn't a part of that. So we would see each other. We were definitely friendly, but we did separate a little bit.
So Monty, around 91, 92, you were listening to Bad Religion's How Could Hell Be Any Worse, and that sort of became the embryo for DFL.
Yeah, definitely. Those early DFL songs were really influenced by that, which apparently I was looking into it. Like, I had a cassette and I was listening to it on my Walkman, like, all the time. And it's like Tom said, it was just, you know, about those early Black Flag recordings. It was just so raw. And the songs just like brought me back to like the Vex or the Starwood or the Fleetwood. And I just felt like I was just reliving those times when I'd listened to that music. And, you know, they would have like moshes, and I don't know. I don't know how I got the cassette, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, it was like the beginning of DFL, because then I started like writing DFL songs, those first DFL songs before there was a band, you know, writing. I think I wrote Pizza Man, maybe Meter Maid. I think those are the two first DFL songs I wrote before we were actually a band, just like writing riffs and coming up with like silly choruses.
So then how did you go from writing tracks, I think you were in college at the time. So you were writing tracks, you were going to college. How did you, I guess, said, well, I'm going to start a band, and who should I start it with?
Well, at that time, kind of fast forward, I got sober, and I was, you know, going to college, getting my life together, married, and had actually a small child, some Bella, and hanging, and we were living in Echo Park. And around that time, an old friend of ours from where I grew up in Hollywood, from Hollywood days, was actually more of a friend with my brother, Michael, was Ione Sky. And then she was dating, and Ione would come around, and I think she came to our, my wife and I, to our baby shower. And I think Ione dated Anthony Kiedis for a minute, and then next thing you know, she was dating Adam Horvitz. And then so Adam Horvitz kind of came into our world. And Anthony also was like a friend, and Flea was a friend, and everybody's hanging out together. And so I was just hanging out with Adam one day, and he and I kind of clicked. And they were in the process of recording Check Your Head. Must have been like 91, I'm guessing, something like that. And they had G-Sun all set up, and I just threw it out there. I was like, hey, I wrote these hardcore songs. You want to hear them? And so we went over to G-Sun. I played the songs, and he liked them. And he's like, and I was like, you know, I've got an idea for a name for a band, DFL, which is a sailing term I learned from my dad, and for sailing races. And anyway, we clicked, and the band clicked, and got in touch with Tom, got in touch with Tony Converse, got in touch with Max Perlick, you know, the whole crew got involved. You know, Mike D played drums for like 2 seconds, and that's kind of the way it came together.
So Monty and Tom, how did you two relink back up together? Because little known fact, which is discussed in detail in the oral history that comes written by yours truly, that the 10,000 word oral history that comes with the reissue of My Crazy Life. There were actually another person that was either supposed to be the true first singer or maybe the duo first singer with Tom. How did you guys link back up together? And who was this mysterious other original singer for DFL?
What a history this thing is. I kind of don't even remember how me and Monty recrossed, except that we had mutual friends, which was Max Perlick was a really good friend of Adam's, and Max and me were smoking pot every day. Max, I can't remember how it happened, but I think just maybe at the farmer's market, Adam was like, hey, well, we're going to practice. Me and Monty are doing this thing. Why don't you and Max come over and smoke out? And, you know, my idea is to have two hardcore singers at the same time do these songs. And we went over and tried to do it. And every time it was time for Max to sing, he would rather smoke instead of sing. So I just mustered up the ability to just kind of squeezed those lyrics out that Monty had pre-written, and we kind of just ad-libbed a few things here and there, and before you knew it, we had these songs.
And Tom, you had never actually sang in a band before that, right?
I have never sang in a band. I kind of played drums in a band or two down in Hermosa, but when I wasn't hanging out with Monty for many years, I was hanging out with the Pennywise guys, and I was at the grassroots of their beginning and just kind of like sucking it all in so many times. So it's just when it was time to pull the trigger, I already had the gun loaded. I was ready to go. I knew what I liked. I knew what I didn't like. And, you know, me and Monty grew up in the 80s hardcore, and I liked everything that was going on. I just wanted to do something a little bit different than what those guys were doing at that time.
So why did Tom, I mean, you came into DFL after Adam and Monty, I guess, said, let's start a band or start a project. Why did the sounds that they were making at the time appeal to you? Or maybe you were like, I'm just going to jump into this, and it formed the way it formed. Like, did you step back and say, this is rad, or did you just dive in and this is what happened, is the question?
I think I was accepted pretty much instantly to just do it. It was either do or die. I didn't want to pass up the ability to not be in a band again after seeing, you know, there was a lot of local Hermosa bands that I could have been a part of that I just kind of didn't. I had either had girlfriends or I had other alternatives. I was focused on skateboarding, and they were real, it was going down, and I wanted to be a part of it. And the sound of Epiphat was already in motion, and this was something different than what was going on.
Yeah, actually, Tom, you bring up a great point, and either Monty or Tom, is was DFL, so at the time of My Crazy Life, is that, as we've said, you know, it was the era of Green Day exploding, and punk was becoming very poppy, very radio friendly. Whereas DFL, I don't want to say it's a throwback, but it's kind of a contemporary take on the classic hardcore sound, which I think is why it's such a legendary, great, and just punchy record. Was the current punk scene something that affected you either positively or negatively, or was DFL and My Crazy Life just created in a vacuum and you guys weren't even thinking about what was popular at the time?
Hit it, Monty.
I'll just say 100%, I was completely oblivious to the punk scene in the early 90s, completely oblivious to the Epitaph thing or to anything, to be perfectly honest. I mean, like I said, I had my Walkman. I was listening to How Could Hell Be Any Worse and hanging out with the Beasties and with other people. But I was pretty oblivious to the punk scene in the early 90s, to be honest. And, you know, people would say that, like what you're saying, like, wow, you know, you guys have like this raw, lo-fi thing that was like totally opposite of what was going on in, you know, more polished kind of punk scene. I mean, I was oblivious. I remember seeing Rancid's CD for Let's Go, which I think is a great record. I mean, every track I really like. But on the back, you know, they have like mohawks and stuff like that. And I was like, whoa, this is like 91. These guys have mohawks. It's crazy. So I was oblivious, as I am most of the time.
So the My Crazy Life record, I believe, was written pretty quickly. You guys recorded it at G-Sun Studio with Mario Caldado was there. Of course, Adam Horovitz was there. Tony Converse was there. What was that one day recording session like? And did you guys realize that you were recording a unique record that really just destroyed the house? Like, what was that one day session like in which you recorded the album?
Well, the recording did happen quickly, but Monty and I, after having a few practices, we were passing a cassette back and forth where Monty would play these riffs and he would yell out like part A, part B, which was verse and chorus. So he'd be like, okay, I have a chorus. This is called Meter Maid. It goes like this. Da, 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 da. And then he said, you just need to write part A. So we were kind of working on the songs for at least a good month before we went and recorded. Once, you know, we saw how the boys were recording, and they were not fucking around. They just did it live. They did it a couple of times and that was it. We really didn't see the background of how much love that they put into the recording with Mario mixing everything, but they were doing everything in one take. So when Monty and I were introduced to that style of recording, it was live, it was raw, it was just in your face, and you had we were there, we were ready to do it. Was familiar with different style of tracking and recording, because hanging out with Fletcher and those guys, they were doing it completely different. They were tracking drums, they were tracking bass, they were tracking guitars, and that's how they had that unique Epitaph sound. It was very good, very professional. It was just something that they weren't doing, live takes mixed down with, you know, a guitar overdub and maybe some vocal overdub.
And I remember, like, when we recorded, you know, the BCs had G-Sun, and they had this big kind of basketball room. It looked like a basketball court, but they also had a skateboard ramp set up, and then they had a stage. And on the stage is where they were doing all their live recording. So all their instruments, drum, bass, guitar, everything was set up. Money Marks, keyboard, and Leslie, everything was set up on the stage. And like, I just brought my amp, and Adam had an amp there. I guess he must have used Yauch's bass amp. And the drums were there, and we just recorded live. And I remember there was, like, I think it was like an Ampeg flip top bass. They're like these bass amps that have like a flip top. And I think that's what you sit, Tom, that's what Tom sang through. Because I remember Mario and Adam wanted the vocals to sound really, really raw. I mean, like, really raw. And I remember I think it was a bass amp or something, but we all stood together on the stage, and, you know, and then they would just say, play the song. And like Tom said, play it once, play it twice, move on. Play it once, play it twice, move on. And it's more like, it's like, you know, like the way you would maybe make a painting or something like that. It's just an impression of the moment, you know, that's what you get. And every DFL record has really been recorded that way. We've never done kind of left that way of doing things, you know, where it's just really raw. Everybody, we record live, maybe add the vocals a little bit later, maybe a guitar, but don't overthink it. Excuse me. And I think you mentioned, John, that we didn't realize that we were making something that was going to be what it was, what it ended up being. I certainly didn't. I mean, we weren't signed to Grand Royal when we recorded all that stuff. Grand Royal was just getting off the ground. I think they had one release, which was I'm totally blanking on the name of it. It's the girl band, Luscious Jackson. I think they had one Luscious Jackson release, maybe. And we just rehearsed the songs, recorded them, and then I think we played a party the next day at G-Sun that they invited a bunch of our friends over, and people were skating, and remember I think Christian Hosoi was skating and maybe Alva, and we played, and that's on the Trust Records release reissue of My Crazy Life. That's the B-side, is this unreleased live stuff that we got, and that Mario graciously mixed and mastered that stuff, which was totally just like the 8 Ampex 2-inch tapes, you know, just the raw stuff that I was able to acquire. And then I was in college, and then I had to go to England. I got a scholarship or a grant to go to England to study needle exchange. And I just kind of forgot about it. And I remember my wife saying, the Beasties released all that stuff on a 7-inch. And she goes, did you know that? And I was like, no. It happened very organically, I'll say. Very organically.
Well, as Monty mentions, the Trust re-release is really cool, and that the A-side has My Crazy Life for the first time ever on 12-inch vinyl, all 15 tracks, which are technically two separate sessions, because originally there's the original 7-inch version, and they recorded some more tracks for the CD version. So now for the first time, that's all on the 12-inch version, which is really cool on the A side. And the B side is this live show that they recorded the day after, and it rips and sounds all. And it's not like a bootleg recording. It's professionally recorded. They record it, I guess, for an archive, or maybe not even with a purpose. And now it's being released, you know, as a professionally recorded live show for the first time ever on the B-side, which is extremely rad. So let's play two tracks and come back. Let's play Meter Maid, and then let's also play some Beastie Boys, because this is the Beastie Boy era. Let's do So What You Want, which everyone's heard before, but it's a kick-ass track, and we'll be right back.
Do it.
And we are back. And now it's 30 years on, 30 years or so since My Crazy Life was first released. What does My Crazy Life mean to you now, Tom and Monty? Looking back, what does the record represent? What does it convey? How does it feel to have this record being released by Trust Records, who, you know, I mean, the record is now codified as, I mean, you guys might be too shy to say so, but I'll say so. The record certainly is a massively important, massively awesome record. And so it's so great to see it codified in the halls of punk rock fame, you know, with the Circle Jerks, with 7 Seconds and so forth. So Monty and Tom and Monty, what's it like to see the record reissue? What does it mean to you now? What does it represent to you now?
Tom, you want to say, or you want me to go?
It feels great. It feels like yesterday. I'm stoked that we got these gold records and shit has gone platinum because it's been an amazing, grateful ride. I'm glad that so many people, I think when we broke up for a few years after our heyday, because of the internet, the stuff was just brewing like fine wine. So the kids are loving it. And, you know, it is as raw and as real as it gets for hardcore punk.
And I guess I'll just add to that, you know, just by way of background, like, I guess in the early 2000s or something like that, Grand Royal went bankrupt, and then some random company bought up their catalog, except for the Beastie stuff, all stayed with Capitol. And I saw it online one day, and I just hit them up. I said, hey, I'm with the band DFL. Can we buy back our masters from you? And they were really cool people, and they sold me the masters. They had the Ampex tapes. They had a VHS of the Pizza Man video, which I thought was completely gone forever. And I shopped it around for a while. You know, me and Tom both shopped it around and tried to get people interested. And finally, you know, just the right thing happened. Greg Hetson from the Circle Jerks introduced me to Joe Nelson from Trust. And that was like 2019, right before the pandemic. And then all throughout the pandemic, we worked on the record. You know, Mario remastered the live side, the studio side. And then he, as I mentioned earlier, he mixed and mastered the live stuff, because that was just raw material on an Ampex 2-inch tape. And you know, and then you, John, you wrote this amazing 10,000 word oral history, you know, which was great. And then I think just the cherry on the top was the packaging, being able to hook up with Brian Ray Turcotte and his partner Art. And they just, you know, took it to a whole other level in terms of just the packaging. I mean, Brian, I went over to his studio, and you know, he's like the, you know, punk rock collector extraordinaire. I mean, you know, and I love collecting stuff. I just keep all my old punk stuff, and he just has a collection that's just insane. And he whipped out this Rodney on the Rock compilation that came with a fanzine, and it had this sleeve that was kind of round on the edges, and he just whipped it out and he goes, this is what I want to do with the My Crazy Life reissue. He said, I want there to be a fanzine in it. And Tom also wanted there to be a fanzine. So that was a good thing. He's like, I want there to be, I want the knucklehead on the cover to be embossed. And fanzine came out great. The packaging is amazing. And now Trust is doing a really great job with spreading the word and getting it out there. We filmed this this One Chew Miu, I guess, not like a podcast, but it's like a video podcast, I guess. But we went over to Grand Royal, and we were able to use the same spot where we recorded the record and at the Grand Royal Studios in this basketball court again. And we had Ione Sky there, and we talked with her. And yeah, it's been amazing. And then, like you said, to kick this off, you know, Friday is release day, you know, so yeah, so I'm stoked. You know, the other thing I'll say is I'm just looking on my shoulder is, so I still got the Ampex tapes here, and the studio version was recorded on April 22nd, 1993, and the party live stuff was April 23rd, 1993. So yeah, it's been like 30 years, right? You know, over 30 years. And since we record that stuff, and again, like Tom said, it just feels really like yesterday. And, you know, I feel like I'm going on, but, you know, right now there's like this hardcore scene is really alive. You know, I think young kids are really getting into hardcore and finding their own voice in hardcore through other bands, you know, so it's cool that Trust is pushing this out there and that we're up there with, you know, our idols like Circle Jerk, 7 Seconds, SSD, Youth Brigade. And then also there's all these new punk bands, these new hardcore bands, like Gel or Scowl or whatever. And, you know, hopefully they'll hear our stuff too and be into it.
Tom, what's the Monty and Tom dynamic in 2023?
Best friends, enjoying each other's company, whether it's good or bad. I mean, we've just, you know, we're both kind of street smart, and we're both just really grateful at where life has taken us, and we don't take anything for granted. You know, we're both not looking back at the past and wishing we could have done something. We know what we've done and we're super proud of it. We have our feet firmly planted in today, and you know, whatever the future brings, we're ready for it, whether it's giant tours like we used to do or whether it's just small backyard parties. We love each other, we love this music, and we love the scene. We're really here to support the scene like it used to be. Support the scene. It's not about the big money, you know, capitalism, punk rock anymore. We used to make fun of Hot Topic and all the bands that broke real big on K-Rock back in the day, but you know, they're still all out there doing that. So you know, there's a place for everybody. We joke around saying, you know, that there's like a giant punk rock table, sort of like the supper of Christ. Forget what that's called, but
Last Supper.
We still have a seat at the table, you know, and it's amazing that we're still here doing this, what we love to do.
And we're at the kids' table. they won't let us at like the big table yet.
Actually brings up an interesting point. Tom, along those lines, is one of the great dynamics of DFL is that you've got these amazing lyrics, and then the band will often not always break into this cool chorus, and you shout out the chorus, and then Monty sometimes echoes or replies, you know. And so I wonder, like, why is it that you and Monty work together so well? It reminds me of Tetris or something. It's where you're both doing something different than each other, but it snapped together so perfectly, and that's why the record hits so hard.
I would just say that, you know, that's just the magic of music. And what that style is called is call and response. So, you know, realistically, like, Monty comes up with a lot of the stuff at first, and, you know, he just kind of brings a direction, and so then we just kind of work on that direction. And you know, it's when guys just sit in a room and they jam like a jam band and they play, I mean, that's where the magic really starts to happen. When it becomes really militant and overworked and oversketched is when it loses its feel. So we try to keep things just as real and as fun as possible. We just had a great practice the other night where I had a few lyrics. You know, we kind of worked on some of Monty's lyrics and brought it to the guys we're jamming with now. And it just sounded really fun. I can see their giant smiles just enjoying rehearsing the new songs that we're going to be putting out in the next year.
And just wanted to add, you know, one of the things I really loved and that I don't take for granted, and I echo everything Tom has to say about our friendship, is Like I would like write like Pizza Man. I'd go Pizza Man, he delivers. And then I wouldn't tell Tom like, oh, you need to do this for the verse or anything like that. I would just be like, just do whatever you want. And I think like Tom is like a poet. You know what I mean? He writes poetry when in his chorus. If you listen to it, I mean, it's not stuff I could write. You know, I write very concrete kind of stuff. I'm not like a poet. And but it just worked because I would just be like, I don't care what Tom is going to say. He's going to say the right things. And so I don't really care. To be perfectly honest, there are some songs that I don't even know what you're saying. And I don't even know the lyrics to the song. You know what I mean? So, and I think pretty much every DFL record we've done that where it's like, you know, I pretty much cook up the music. Tom will kind of give me some edits in terms of like, try this, try that. I'll sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes I'll think up like a cool chorus, like Pizza Man or Proud to Be or whatever. And then I just am hands off with Tom. I'm like, just put the lyrics, you know, the lyrics go here. I mean, Tom knows where the lyrics go for a verse. And then he just fucking does his thing, which I think is cool. You know,
that's the magic right there.
You can't take that stuff doesn't grow on trees. You know what I mean? That was one of the things I was really grateful for with our last record. Why Are You DFL? We did the same thing. And to me, that record sounded like it came out right after our last record in the 90s. And I love that. I love that it just sounded like it had that same DFL sound.
Well, there you have it. As both Monty and Tom said, that magic doesn't grow on trees, which is very true. Last question, both Tom and Monty and Tom, and then we'll play a track and shut this on down because the reissue for My Crazy Life is out this Friday. Via Trust Records. You can get it at your record store or you can get it online at trustrecords.com. It's super rad. I realize that I've got a stake in it, that I wrote the oral history, but listen, people, it really is rad. First of all, I mean, the most important part is the actual record, the music itself is just absolutely killer. It's some of the best hardcore, and I'm dead serious about this. It is some of the best hardcore ever written. I realize Tom and Monty probably can't, you know, co-sign that or say, yes, it is, because it might be kind of bad, but it really is. It is just a record that just whips and destroys. It's fast, it's funny, it's intelligent, and it just everything to me that what hardcore should be and sometimes is, but a lot of times isn't. But on top of that, it's got the entire unreleased live album on the B-side, which is just as killer. It's got the zine by Brian Ray Turcotte, which has got a ton of really cool and interesting pictures. It's got the oral history written by yours truly, and the actual packaging itself is just absolutely fantastic. Trust really, really did do a really nice job on the record itself. So kudos to you guys both. So Monty and Tom and Monty, what would you like people to take from DFL overall? Or do you have any closing words or you can plead the fifth?
I would just like to say to you, John, thank you so much for what you've done for us recently. We do love the article that you wrote. And, you know, we're just real grateful. We are just doing what we do best. You know, we're writing hardcore songs. We're going to work in the day, having fun at night. And, you know, it's all about second chances.
Yeah. Thank God for second chances. And just again, thank you, John. Appreciate all your support. Appreciate everything that you've done with the blood, sweat, and tears with the oral history. And yeah, just look for DFL. You know, we're just, I want to say that, you know, that we're, you know, there's still so many things for us to do in the future. You know what I mean? I feel like although Tom and I are getting older, there's still a lot left for us to do. So, you know, we look forward to getting out there and playing all over the States and playing all over the world, you know, and turning people on to our music. I mean, there's nothing better than turning people on to our music and seeing people really, really enjoy it, or having people come and tell us and be like, yeah, you know, I love your music, I love this song, or they have a knucklehead tattoo or whatever. Or today somebody messaged us a picture that their daughter drew of him wearing, and it was like this girl must have been like seven, I guess, and she drew a picture of her dad, and her dad happened to be wearing like a DFL t-shirt, so she drew that also. This is so cool, man.
Well, it is so cool. Let's play two final tracks. Once again, the reissue of My Crazy Life is out via Trust Records. Go out and buy it. You won't be sorry. It's friggin' awesome. Let's play a new DFL track, Why Are You DFL, off their reunion EP, which I think is one of the best reunion records ever. So this is Why Are You DFL off the album, Why Are You DFL. And then after that, we're going to close it out with the all-time classic, Pizza Man, Pizza Man, Pizza Man, He Delivers. And Monty and Tom, thanks again. And we'll see you.
Thank you, man. Thank you, John. Thank you, John. Monty. All right, everyone. Likewise, have a good night.
Later. Love you guys.